From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I talk with two members of a support group for people who test positive for the AIDS antibody. Testing positive means you've been exposed to AIDS. It doesn't necessarily mean you'll get it. Also today, I talk with Guy Klusevic, a composer and accordionist who's moved far beyond accordion jokes but hasn't lost his sense of humor. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles Television, the group that opened the door for the New York punk club scene, and book critic John Leonard reviews Mothers of Invention, a look at the role of women in the advancement of technology. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Many people who fear they've been exposed to AIDS have taken the AIDS antibody test. This test tells you if you've been exposed to the AIDS virus. If you test positive, it means you're at risk, but it doesn't mean you'll necessarily get AIDS. People who test positive confront a waiting game, a game that can play on all their fears and throw their futures into question. Support groups for people who test positive are beginning to form around the country. Michael Hirsch is the founder and director of one such group, the New York chapter of Body Positive. Hirsch also co-founded and directed the People with AIDS Coalition in New York. Hirsch was diagnosed as having AIDS 6 months ago. I spoke with Michael Hirsch from the NPR Bureau in New York. Joining us was a member of the support group Body Positive. He chose to use the name Bob for our broadcast to protect his privacy. Bob is a New York-based actor. He tested positive, but does not have AIDS. I asked Michael Hirsch to explain what information the test gives you.
It tells you that you've been exposed to the virus. If you have tested positive, it tells you that you should consider yourself a carrier of the virus, so you have to act responsibly in intimate sexual relationships. It doesn't tell you if you're going to get sick, when you're going to get sick, how sick you're going to get, or if you're going to die.
Are there odds that the medical profession gives now, odds that you would get AIDS if you test positive for it?
Based on information we have from San Francisco and here in New York, it looks like the longer you live with the virus in your system, the greater the chance you will start showing symptoms and getting sick. Doctors give a range of 35 to 75%, and they don't really give a time factor. So we tend to not concentrate on that since it's such a debatable issue.
If you have been exposed to the AIDS virus, how soon would that show up in a test?
Well, we thought we knew the answer to that one, but now there are studies from abroad which say it is possible that it could be 6 months to a year before the antibodies show themselves on a test. Generally, it is most commonly accepted that it takes, 3 to 5 months. Myself, because I was a participant in another study for hepatitis vaccines, and my blood has been on file, it actually took me 4 months before I was testing positive. So there again, AIDS and the issue of AIDS creates a lot more questions than there are answers. And I would be careful of anyone who says, I have the answer, to anything, because it's also questionable.
Are there estimates on the number of people now who test positive for the antibody?
Conservatively, here in New York City, we talk about there being around 400,000 people in the New York City area. Nationally, somewhere around 1.4 to 1.7 million Americans.
Now, Michael, you organized the New York City branch of Body Positive. Why did you want to organize that self-help group?
I had previously been a part of the People with AIDS Coalition, took some time off, was in London with the founder of the Connecticut branch, and we talked rather extensively about this largest category of affected people, how in fact they had no direct services, direct information, yet they offered the greatest potential because they were still healthy. They still had, for the most part, jobs, resources, and energy to make a difference in their lives and hopefully the lives of others who were not affected. So it was a matter of, it was the perfect group of people to tap into and organize to help themselves. It was a, no pun intended, it could be a positive experience, which it has turned out to be.
Bob, let me introduce you into the conversation. Why did you want to join a self-help group for people who test positive?
Well, I think because, first of all, the very first day that I found out I was positive, I went to a group, and I felt the first thing you want to do is have somebody to talk to. At least that was my response. If you can't call your mother up and immediately tell her, then you want to have somebody else to talk to. And the safest people to talk to are people who are in the same, having the same experience.
Bob, why did you decide to get the test?
I thought that I wasn't really being, in a phrase, I guess I'd say I wanted to be confrontational with the virus. I decided I wanted to really look at this and be as direct as I could, and I felt like I was strong enough to do that. I wouldn't suggest everybody do that, but I felt like it might make a difference and make me be a little more responsible and just be confrontational, just decide what I wanted to do about it.
Michael, why did you decide to get the test?
I don't know that I'm the best example because I am already a person with AIDS. I took the test months and almost a year after I was sick. It was sort of anticlimactic. But I should say the way we talk about the test is we talk in terms of people being totally responsible for their actions. And if that means they should take the test voluntarily, anonymously, so they can find out information and behave appropriately with another sex partner, etc., that's what we want people to do. And that's what I encourage people to do. But I had the test after the fact, but it was still extremely devastating, I must tell you. And I was well-versed on the issues of AIDS and had friends and was a executive director of an organization working with people with AIDS. And when I found out, I was devastated.
So being politically and socially involved with other self-help groups didn't fully prepare you personally for getting AIDS yourself?
No, not at all. The test is, hearing the news for me, I felt it was sort of a very final judgment, and it's a hard thing to adjust to.
Let me just clarify something, Michael. I mean, we're talking about a test that basically tells you if you've been exposed to the antibody. You had already been sick with problems that you thought were AIDS-related. What information did the test give you that your doctor hadn't already provided?
It was just a confirmation, that's uh-huh. all. It was a confirmation to see if all the weight loss, the headaches, the fevers. Prior to that, we were assuming it was AIDS-related, but this is the barometer that the system uses, meaning for, you know, determining what you've got and then to hopefully get you assistance and benefits. The HIV test is a, you know, it's a system that they use. And that's not even entering into the debate that we're not going to touch upon in terms of whether HIV is the cause or not.
Bob, I think a lot of people take the test hoping that they'll test negative and so that they don't have to worry about it. Did you think ahead to what you would do if you actually tested positive for the antibody when you decided to take the test?
Did I think ahead? Well, you know, I should say something. The last time I took the test and tested positive was the third time I'd taken the test. And I did get the first time an inconclusive, and the doctor felt he needed to do it again, but he told me that it probably would be positive. He did it again, and 2 weeks later told me that, to his surprise and mine, that it was negative. It was 2 years later that I took it for the third time, and it was positive. I was prepared for anything, mm-hmm. As you can see, because I got everything. But at the same time, I don't think you can... it's important maybe to share it with a few people and think about it, your response, but it's something you just deal with when it comes. You have to know yourself through your life before you decide to do something like this. And if you think you're going to, you know... lose your mind, you don't do it. I mean, you find another way to cope if it's too heavy to handle.
When you tested positive, how did the doctor tell you?
That's one of my bones of contention here. That's maybe one of the reasons why I'm here specifically, is that he told me over the phone. And that's the last time I spoke to this doctor. Now, he's not my doctor, you know, my, in fact, I really didn't have a doctor. But he also did it as a courtesy. The test was done through the city facilities. I was charged nothing. But I don't think it's very ethical to give anyone the results of a test like this over the phone and wish them luck and send them on their way.
There are many horror stories. If you'd like, I can share what I consider the worst case.
Why don't you?
In Washington, a friend of mine's roommate's lover, if you follow that connection, a volunteer at a local AIDS organization, well-educated on all the issues, tested positive, was given no counseling, and within 48 hours committed suicide by putting a gun to his head. There are other variations on that. A mother who is a drug user in Brooklyn at a methadone clinic being tested, not fully being explained what the test was, what the information was. When they gave her results, they gave it to her in written form in an envelope like she were winning an Academy Award. When she became justifiably upset and started crying, the supposed quote-unquote counselor said, if you don't stop crying, I'm going to leave the room. There is a big problem of doctors and health-related officials not understanding the ramifications of getting information about potentially dying. It is the ultimate piece of information. It is the one that has to be treated with utmost professionalism, respect, courtesy, love, nurturing, and support. It's not the kind of thing that you do over a phone. It's not the kind of thing you do unless you can give it the proper time. And there's no way of saying what that proper time is. Government officials talk about counseling like if everyone got one 40-minute session, that'll be enough. There are a lot of people in our support groups that don't need, there are some people who don't need counseling. Most people need some level of support, nurturing, help, understanding, compassion. There are those people who become dysfunctional. This is the kind of information that dramatically affects your lives and the way you see yourself and other people. It's not something you can just sort of toss out.
I think one of the most frightening things, perhaps, for someone who has no symptoms of AIDS but who tests positive for the antibody is that you're almost in this limbo period because you really don't know if this means that you'll get AIDS or not, because what were the chances? You said 35% to 75%. That's so broad. So it's information that is so vague in a way. You know, you just don't know what it's going to mean for you personally. So then you have to decide what kind of changes are you going to make in your life or in your plans. You know, what are you going to do with the information, Bob? I imagine that's a very difficult thing about testing positive.
Yeah, an upheaval in your life. I mean, if you know that you have, I mean, there are all kinds of parlor games, like if you have 5 minutes left to live, what would you want to do with your life? I mean, but
right.
When that's not a parlor game anymore, and you don't know. I mean, if you have 5 years, if you have 10 years, if you have forever. But one of the positive, as Michael said, there are positive things about taking the test besides maybe coming back positive. And one of those things is being maybe confrontational with your own mortality and making decisions based on I don't have forever. I don't. Nobody does, you know. And I think we all invest a lot in pretending that we do live forever. And when you know for certain that you're at risk for a disease from the media and everything is obviously a very terrifying thing. You make choices. And hopefully you, like I was telling Michael before we came in here today, I've tried to add more meaning to my career. I just didn't want to just say, oh, I'll do that because you're going to pay me to do it. I tried to think, what nurtures me? What makes me feel valuable as a human being instead of just getting through my life as many people do?
I should add, you hit upon something, and I'm going to jump in. Hopefully you don't mind. The idea of, now that you have this information, what do you do? Meaning, are you going to live a year, 6 years? Are you going to be in pain? Are you going to be in discomfort? Briefly, in case your viewers, or listeners as they're called,
right.
don't know, the way the antibody or the AIDS virus sort of behaves is it's similar to a herpes virus. It's a retrovirus. It sort of hangs out in your cell and goes to sleep. And something wakens it up into an active stage, and something speeds it along to sort of do what it does, which is, you know, attacking certain other cells. There is considerable thought that there might be things we can do in our lives to make sure it stays asleep and doesn't wake up, or if it does wake up, it moves slowly, or something like that. And some of the things that we counsel and a lot of people are doing is some of the most obvious stuff. They're eliminating alcohol. They're stopping smoking. They're attempting to reduce stress and maybe do something that is stress reduction on a permanent basis, like meditating daily, like doing yoga, riding a bicycle. People start exercising, and obviously nutrition is a big part. The idea is to not shake up the system, but maybe keep things status. To just be positive and still be able to work and live and love is what we really ultimately want to do. And some of these other things we think will make a positive impact on the situation.
Well, I want to talk with you both more about the support group Body Positive and about how people's lives change by the information that they have tested positive for the antibody to the virus believed to cause AIDS. But first, we're going to take a short break. Let me introduce my guests. I'm speaking with Michael Hirsch, who's the executive director of the self-help group Body Positive. And I'm also speaking with Bob, who has tested positive for the antibody to the virus that causes AIDS. And we'll talk some more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
I'm joined by two people who are a member of the support group Body Positive, a group for people who test positive for the antibody to the virus that causes AIDS. Michael Hirsch is the founder of the group. Bob is a member of the group. And I should mention that Michael recently found out that he has AIDS. Bob, I have a question for you. You know, you mentioned the parlor game a few minutes ago, one that we've all mentally played. Mm-hmm. Say you have 5 minutes left to live. How would you change your life? My scenario is always, well, I'd make sure that I had as, you know, much pleasure crammed into every minute as I could get. You know, I'd like eat for pleasure and travel for pleasure and, you know, see people for pleasure. You know what I mean? That's the kind of standard scenario. Now, on the other side, you know, you're both saying and understandably that what you want to do if you find out you test positive is really build up your body, build up its resistance. And to me, those are like really two counter notions. You know what I mean? If you feel that the longevity of your life is threatened, I don't know, that this parlor game isn't really going to pay off at all, you know? Like, well, you cramming in all the pleasure.
You can enjoy yourself and not totally destroy your body. I mean, you know, yeah, I can eat a lot of Haagen-Dazs, and I don't think that I'm, you know, it may not be a recommended cure for AIDS, but it may make me feel very good. And I can get lots of hugs and kisses, and, you know, I can get a lot of things that keep me happy and aren't dangerous to my health. In the 5 minutes left.
No, I mean,
five minutes is too short a period.
Also, this isn't the parlor game we talk about. There is a difference here. There is a considerable amount of unknown. And everyone, scientists and people involved and affected, there is a sense of belief. There is no factual hard data, but some stuff does seem to make a difference. We knew that stress reduction made a difference in heart disease and in cancer. So given that information, and we're using the same system, meaning the human body, there's strong reason and evidence to believe that it might have a similar positive result here by doing some good things for yourself.
Who are the people, Bob, who you told when you... I don't mean name names or anything, but mm-hmm. I think it's a big decision trying to figure out who you're going to tell if you found out that you test positive. Some people could really misinterpret the information. Some people could not want, you know, get very paranoid about it. I don't know. How did you decide who were you going to share this information with?
I pretty much told anyone in my life that I was, you know, close to that. I was, my family, I haven't told all of them. Some are elderly and I'm concerned about that. And I haven't made the decision. I think I will, but I haven't made the decision as to when and how I'm going to do that. But
you're concerned that it would be too upsetting with them or that they wouldn't really understand what it means?
Right. I think, you know, if for any reason I had to say I had, if I were to say I had ARC, if I were to say I had AIDS, I certainly wouldn't hide that from my family. I think that'd be preposterous. But at this point, and not knowing what to tell them, I hope that maybe in 2 or 3 years I'll have more information to give them. There'll be more data, you know. I'll feel like there's something to say, as opposed to I took this test, I'm positive, and now we don't know what's going to happen. This limbo thing that you're talking about, and some people deal with limbo okay, and some people don't. Some people create the worst scenario for themselves, and I think that's what you have to avoid.
Michael, you see so many people in the support group that you've organized. Do you think that people who test positive should tell all of the doctors that they see, the dentists and doctors and so on, that they test positive? Since you mentioned before that they should consider themselves carriers.
I think people should act responsibly and be totally in control of what they're doing. And any time that they're in a situation that someone else might be at risk, the ideal situation is yes, to tell them. And in this case, I mean, that's what I usually tell people. And by being a part of a support group with 9 or 10 other people who become like an extended family, people get to better understand a sense of responsibility, self-control, compassion. And if they don't understand that, I suspect they attain that understanding over a period of weeks.
How do you answer friends and acquaintances who ask you if you test positive? And you don't really know them very well, and you think it's maybe too forward a question. I mean, it's not like you're going to have an intimate relationship or anything. I don't know if that happens.
Well, I can describe to you a conversation I had with someone else. Here in New York, because politicians have so misabused the concept of testing and made it into some sort of battering ram to torture people with emotionally, you would best go to a place like San Francisco, where I understand it is more commonplace for people to be extremely understanding. I have a friend of mine who just came back, was in a bar, and, you know, conversations of I'm positive, I'm ARC, I'm AIDS, are not treated with anything other than support. People's reactions are, so am I. I have a friend. I'm a volunteer. My mother helps out here. And I think that's more of an ideal situation. Here in New York, health commissioners and politicians and everyone who is not directly affected has an opinion that is quite offensive and not quite understanding. You know, in other countries like Sweden and I think Switzerland, testing isn't such a big thing. It's voluntary. It's compassionate. So people can find out information and act like adults.
But Bob, do you feel that people ask you sometimes who you feel it's not really any of their business?
I think one of the safest things to say is if you're, and unfortunately many people assume this, if you're a homosexual, you live in New York City, you've been sexually active, you can assume without taking the test that you've put yourself at risk. Now, I don't mean that, you know, everyone should act that, but in other words, if you don't want to answer the question, you can say, I haven't taken the test and I assume I'm positive, if you really wanted to be discreet about it.
If you assumed you're positive, or if you are positive, you would act in the same way. You would do only safe things. You would take precautions. You would err on the side of being too safe. You would not do something, or you would do it different.
Let me just ask you one sex question. If you are
only one.
if you test positive and therefore you're assuming you're a carrier of AIDS, do you think that you should practice safe sex, or what's now being called safer sex, or do you think that like celibacy would be a more appropriate form of practice? What do you think?
You can take it first.
Well, I think, first of all, it's a psychological, emotional issue. I mean, I think it's important to have someone explain safe sex to you. It's important to take a condom out, to handle it, touch it. It's important to talk about anal sex. It's important to talk about oral sex. It's important to talk about these things. I think that's... But psychologically, not everybody's ready to go and try safe sex. You may want to just abstain. If that's what you choose to do, then that's fine too. But I think there are you know, a myriad of ways that human beings can achieve climax together without endangering one another. And it's almost fun finding out.
There are, to borrow the phrase of a recent book, I mean, there are lots of other erogenous zones other than, you know, our sexual organs. There's, you know, I, for one, get very stimulated in my neck area and my nipples, and that's pretty safe.
Okay. Let me ask you, you've both taken the test. Who would you recommend if somebody asked you, should I take it? What would you say? When do you think it's worth taking it, since it leaves you in this state of uncertainty about your own future?
Well, one of the reasons I decided to take it is that, yes, it is uncertain. It is limbo or whatever, but there are things you can do. I'm taking something you buy. You could buy in a health food store. It's called AL721.
It's lipids, which is
It's either soy or egg lipids, and it's been shown in some studies, and there's more, hopefully more information coming in, that it can. It's not toxic. It can help prevent the virus from invading the T cells, which is how it works, or how it does its job, supposedly. Now, if you take the test and you start doing that, then you may be prolonging your life. You may, provided you don't have so much stress that you knock months off your life the other direction. So you have to be ready for the results, and then you have to be the kind of person who would go out and do something to stay healthy. And if you're that kind of person, then not only should you take the test, but you can, by doing it, you can be more helpful to yourself and to other people.
There are lots of things that, you know, that I do lots of phone counseling, and I run the initial drop-in orientation groups when people come into the group. And there's a lot of information that I tell people to do, which I think truly does make a difference. And some of it may sound frivolous, and how can it be serious, and how can it have an effect? But it does have an effect, because I used it. I tell people, if they can afford it, when you find out you're positive and you have the time, go on a vacation for a week and just relax. And surround yourself with good and positive things. You know, don't put yourself in the worst possible situation where you're frenetic and you're upset to begin with. And then on the top of it, in the back of your mind, is that creeping thought of, I'm positive, you know.
Michael, can I ask you to give the phone number of your support group, and could people from other parts of the country call you for information and possibly about support groups near them?
The phone number in New York City is 212-633-1782. I'll repeat that, 212-633-1782. And we will mail a free newsletter, a single free newsletter to anyone that wants, and with some information about some other groups in your area. Most AIDS service providers in your area, and there are now 300 of them across the country, offer some program, but we would be more than happy to send a free newsletter.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us, and I wish you both the best with your health. And thank you again for your time and for sharing some of your experiences.
Thank you.
My guests have been Michael Hirsch and Bob. Michael Hirsch is the executive director of the group Body Positive, the New York City branch, and Bob is a member of that group. It's a support group for people who test positive for the antibody to the AIDS virus. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with William Grider. He's the political reporter for Rolling Stone magazine and a former assistant managing editor for The Washington Post. He's the author of the new book, Secrets of the Temple, How the Federal Reserve Runs the Country. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with Guy Klusevic, a composer and accordionist who gave up polkas for new music, then merged the two in his commission series Polkas from the Fringe. Also, rock historian Ed Ward reviews the brief career of Television, one of New York's first punk bands. And book critic John Leonard reviews Mothers of Invention, a chronicle of little-remembered women who furthered science and technology. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. Nicaraguan Contra leaders today agreed to hold direct ceasefire negotiations with the Sandinista government. At a news conference in Miami, members of the Contra leadership said they would meet with mediator Miguel Obando y Bravo later this week. But the rebels are skeptical. Contra director Pedro Chamorro said he does not think Ortega is serious about living up to the terms of a regional peace plan.
The amnesty plan of the Sandinistas is not a real amnesty. It's an exchange of one punishment for another, an exchange of a punishment of jail for expatriation.
Despite the apparent breakthrough in peace negotiations, the White House today announced the resumption of lethal supply airdrops to the Contras. The White House has said military pressure on the Sandinista government is responsible for the latest moves toward peace. A Pennsylvania couple has been granted political asylum in the Soviet Union. The Soviet Foreign Ministry today announced the defection of Theodore and Cheryl Branch. From Moscow, NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
Foreign Ministry spokesman Gennady Gerasimov described the Branches as specialists in media questions who came to the Soviet Union as tourists in 1987. He said they'll be given housing and jobs, but he didn't say where they currently live or where they'll settle. Gerasimov described the couple as political emigres whose request to remain in the Soviet Union was based on their preference for socialism rather than capitalism. Gerasimov said Theodore Branch is 43 years old and his wife Cheryl is 40. The spokesman gave no other details about the couple, and the U.S. Embassy in Moscow said it knew nothing about them. This is Ann Cooper in Moscow.
From Erie, Pennsylvania, Theodore Branch's father, Clarence Branch, was interviewed by the Associated Press. The elder Branch reportedly said the childless couple was stupid, that's a quote, for deciding to live in the Soviet Union. Israel today moved to end an 11-day commercial strike in the occupied territories. In the West Bank town of Ramallah, Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin announced a ban on outside shipments of food and clothing to Palestinians in the region. Rabin said the ban would be enforced as long as shopkeepers in the West Bank and Gaza maintained a strike marking 40 days of anti-Israeli disturbances. Candidates aligned with Philippine President Corazon Aquino scored a number of impressive victories in provincial and local elections yesterday, but incomplete poll results also suggest that Aquino has far less influence nationwide than many people believed. NPR's Alan Berlow has more from Manila.
In congressional elections last year, candidates endorsed by Aquino won more than 90% of the seats, but Monday's voting demonstrated that Aquino has far less influence at the local level. Senator Ernesto Maceda characterized Aquino's victory as marginal.
Certainly, she did not win by a knockout. The most that I could say is it was an unimpressive victory on points simply because she's the champion, and normally when the bout is unimpressive, you give it to the champion.
Two distinct parties appear to have emerged from the local elections, one aligned with Aquino, the other with the president of the Philippine Senate. The big losers in the elections were political parties aligned with former President Marcos, Aquino's vice president, Salvador Laurel, and her former defense minister, Juan Ponce Enrile. None of these parties demonstrated any real clout in Monday's balloting. I'm Alan Berlo in Manila.
The Supreme Court today rejected an attempt by Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North to block a criminal probe of the Iran-Contra affair. The action clears the way for independent counsel Lawrence Walsh to seek indictments against North and other key participants in the scandal. Stock prices fell sharply today on Wall Street. A sell-off in the final minutes of trading sent the Dow Jones Industrial Average down 28 points to close at 1935. I'm Sharon Green, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of the band Television. Back in the 70s, this group helped originate the punk scene in New York, even though they themselves weren't really punks. Many contemporary groups like R.E.M. and Squeeze claim Television's music as an influence on their own.
It was like a dream. Two boyhood friends, Richard Lloyd and Tom Miller, who had grown up in boarding schools in the South, came to New York to be artists. They succeeded, and in doing so, they began a piece of rock and roll history which is still reverberating. Miller first arrived in New York in 1968, after dropping out of a number of colleges. He decided that he wanted to be a poet and began publishing stuff under the name Tom Verlaine, taking the name of the famous French symbolist poet in tribute. But Tom also liked to play guitar. And when his old friend Richard Myers showed up in New York, they formed a band called the Neon Boys in 1973. Myers figured Tom shouldn't be the only one to change his name, so he became Richard Hell. Then, later in the year, Richard Lloyd joined up, and they changed the name of the band to Television. The name was actually a pun, as this early recording of Little Johnny Jewel makes plain.
Trying to television. Well, some thought this was sad, and others thought it mad. They just scratching the surface. JJ could do the floor kiss. Or was he on display? No, no, not today. Oh, that guy ever said, he said, I want my little wing head. He'd be half asleep at night, over his head, sensation of flight. And he'd wake up dreaming.
As you can hear, Verlaine was writing some weird poetry and wasn't the greatest singer. But he and Lloyd were a perfect guitar duo. Still, Television, like most of the bands in New York, faced a problem. No place to play. Verlaine had been hanging out with a poet named Patti Smith a lot, and had even collaborated with her on a book of poetry. One day, she came over to his house and said that she'd passed a new bar on the Bowery that was failing miserably in its attempt to present country bluegrass and blues to an audience of bikers. Tom headed down to the place, which was called CBGB for Country, Bluegrass, and Blues, and asked the owner, Hilly Crystal, if his band could play there on an off night. Crystal asked if they had any fans, and Verlaine, probably lying, said sure. Before long, word had spread, and an acoustic trio from Rhode Island, Talking Heads, and a very loud bunch from Long Island, who were friends of Patti Smith's, the Ramones, and Patti's own band, the Patti Smith Group, were also playing there regularly. But it was television who had started the trek to CBGB, and even though they weren't at all like most of the bands who played there, they developed a legion of fans. Songs like See No Evil became big favorites, and although a lot of the bands on the new scene were reacting against long, indulgent guitar solos, nobody minded when Verlaine and Lloyd began bouncing ideas off of each other because they were great. Still, even though they made two nearly perfect records for Elektra, nobody bought them, and by 1978 the band disintegrated, largely because of Richard Lloyd's mounting drug habit. Verlaine has made some excellent solo records, and this year, Richard Lloyd, cleaned up, released a magnificent album, Real Time, recorded live at CBGB, where it all started. Good as these records are, though, they remind us that television, like all the best rock and roll, was a part of its time. The time has passed, but the records are still out there for you to discover.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. Listening to Fresh Air. Composer and accordionist Guy Klusewicz got his start playing polkas, but he found his home in the avant-garde. He's expanded the accordion repertoire with his own compositions and with new works he's commissioned by such contemporary composers as John Zorn, Wayne Horvitz, and Robert Previtt. He's performed in settings as diverse as the Brooklyn Philharmonic, the American Composers Orchestra, the Merce Cunningham Dance Company, and the new music ensemble Relâche. We invited Klusewicz to our studio for an interview and asked him to bring his accordion.
Thank you.
That's a beautiful piece. You know, I'm looking at your instrument and looking at all the buttons next to the keyboard and thinking that in a lot of ways the accordion predates the synthesizer.
Well, it's really, it takes as its precedent probably the organ. I mean, the register stops are kind of akin to organ stops, and instead of combining pipes, they combine reeds. And unlike the synthesizer, you can't really create different sound qualities. You can't make it sound like a clarinet or sound like a bassoon, but you can combine reed stops in different way to create different colors.
What are some of the colors you can get from the instrument you have now?
Well, there's a very low reed in the right hand, which goes down into the left hand range. Later on in this piece that I was playing at the opening scenes from A Mirage, I have this very low passage like this. And then the range goes up into the stratosphere. The high reed is way up in the piccolo range. And then there's a very pretty middle range. Which is more of a kind of a woodwind texture that I associate a lot with the instruments. And then you can, those are basically the three reeds. There's a low reed, a middle reed, and a high reed. And then you have all the possible combinations of those, which are more thick textures. Here's all four reeds at one time, which is kind of the traditional accordion sound, all the reeds going all the time.
The Lady of Spain sound.
Yeah, that's it. You just throw everything on you have and let it wail.
How did you first start playing accordion?
It was a cliche. I saw it on television, and I don't remember.
But who did you see playing it?
I can't remember, but I take my dad's word for it. He just said, I saw somebody playing it, and I just bothered him, you know, for a month every day until he bought me one.
Were you interested in polkas?
I got interested in them. Once I moved to Western Pennsylvania, I was raised by an aunt and uncle who were Slovenian, and all of the family functions at the time, picnics or weddings, were ethnic functions. So what was being played by the band was not top 40. And I wrote a lot of polkas myself. I had a little band. And then at some point I became disinterested in them because the mentality of the kind of lyrics of the polkas were always kind of middle America. The wife stays in the house and we go out drinking and bowling with the guys and all this. And so, and then the music started to sound more and more like elevator music. I mean, they were not writing polkas out of the Slovenian community, but they were, like Frankie Yankovic was turning out movie time polkas. You know, he would cash in on whatever movie themes were popular at the time and do polka versions, and it seemed like a self-parody, and I lost interest for many years.
Now, one of your big projects now is commissioning composers to write short polkas for you.
Right.
It's part of an extended piece called Polka from the Fringe. Mm-hmm. Are you back into polkas again?
Yeah, I am. I got interested in them again through Spanish music. I started hearing a lot of Tex-Mex music, and what was so great about Tex-Mex music was that there was a real tradition of virtuosic accordion playing. The players really got around on their instruments, on these little button accordions, and the music remained rather pure because they were ethnically isolated. So it seemed to me musically it was interesting because it was a combination of German and Czech forms, polkas and waltzes. I really got excited about it, and that led to the idea of why don't I ask all these other people who have always wanted to write pieces for me, why not ask them to write a short piece? They'd probably have time to do that, and the form would be what bound it all together. And so I have 20 of them now from the kind of New York experimental scene.
Would you play one of them for us?
Sure. Elliot Sharp, this is an exception to the rule. Elliot's polka was already written. He didn't write this specifically for me. I'm doing a cover version of it. It's called Happy Chappy Polka.
Got a little box where I keep all my things. Got running water, living like a king. Got all I want, and it's always tough to eat. Even got a little girl likes to rub my feet. Oh, I'm a happy chappy, oh, I'm a happy chappy, oh. I'm a happy chappy, oh, I'm a happy chappy, oh. Got blue skies overhead when I open up my eyes. Got no rain, no misery, I'm never gonna die. Got lovely smiles, cause I wear the latest styles. Can't even begin to count my blessings, oh. I'm a happy chappy, oh, I'm a happy chappy, oh. I'm a happy chappio. I'm a happy chappio. Oh, I'm a happy chappio. I'm a happy chappio. I'm a happy chappio. I'm a happy chappio.
That's really funny. It's really great. And this all makes me think that my mother was right when she said to me in high school, Terry, the things that you think are very square today, you will really appreciate when you grow up.
Well, I think that's true of the accordion, too. You know, I was playing it for... I've lived through the whole trend of it being an incredibly popular instrument to being an instrument that became a total cliché, to now being an instrument which is really hip.
But there's probably a period for you where it was maybe fairly embarrassing to tell people that your instrument was the accordion.
Oh, sure. I would, if somebody asked me what I played, I'd say, oh, keyboards, or I'd mumble, and I didn't want to get into a 20-minute discussion. I think what's strange is that when you're a child, you make very intuitive decisions. You know, you just do something because it feels right. And then there comes a point when it seems like it's an attitude to still be doing it. Now, if you're still playing accordion, it's like, how can you be doing that when you know how square it is? But by that time, your attitude about it has already been shaped, and you didn't make the decision as an adult. So it's not an attitude, it's a way of life by that time.
In order to have a repertoire, you basically almost have to commission people to write things for you, because there isn't much, is there, written for accordion?
Well, there is. There's a lot of European music that's been written since the 50s. Unfortunately, a lot of it is kind of academic European music. It comes out of the conservatory, and it's very kind of post-Bartokian and not original. And so the kinds of music that I'm interested in are not being written for the instrument unless I ask for it.
Do you ever have a problem of people thinking, oh, great, a funny piece for the accordion, you know?
Sure. It's, you know, there has to be a point when you move beyond the image of the accordion to getting into the specific sound qualities of it and not just what it conjures up mentally. In other words, once the piece is over, if you remember the tune or you remember the sound quality of the piece, rather than just remembering that it was an accordion, it was funny. I mean, the accordion in many instances is a sight gag. You see it and people start laughing even before you play.
Guy, thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Can you play something else for us?
Sure.
An original composition?
Oh, why not? This is a piece called Old Woman Who Dances with the Sea, and I'll just play a little excerpt of it.
Guy Klusevic can be heard on his new album, Scenes from a Mirage. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story is he following?
Well, you know, the Contras say that they will talk with Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega, so we'll be talking with the Contras. We'll also have a report about Delaware's Governor Pete DuPont, a Republican presidential hopeful, how his campaign is going. A report about an Israeli delegation in Moscow. Of course, the Soviet Union and Israel haven't had diplomatic relations for about 20 years now, since the 1967 war. And also a report from John Burnett about Port Arthur, Texas, and how that town has now decided to have a remembrance of one of its most famous daughters, Janis Joplin.
Well, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Book critic John Leonard has a review of Mothers of Invention. It's about the unsung women who have contributed to scientific advancements and who have dreamed up or created some of our niftier gadgets.
Mothers of Invention is a great idea, if a trifle breezy in the execution. Ethelianne Vare, the biographer of such rock stars as Stevie Nicks and Ozzy Osbourne, and Greg Patchick, features editor of City Sports magazine, want us to appreciate the role that women have played in inventing the world we live in, from the Barbie doll and the bra to nuclear fission and solar heating. They've dipped a bit into history and crossed the Atlantic a couple of times to England and Europe, ignored Asia entirely, and spent most of their time and energy in the United States, going over old patents. What they have to say will surprise anybody still so idiotic as to think that women never get out of the kitchen or the cave. Just to be random about it, women by themselves or on somebody else's team invented or designed or discovered pink champagne and the prototype computer, the square-bottomed bag and nitrate fertilizer, tract housing and penicillin, the ice cream cone and integral calculus, drip coffee and modern abstract algebra, food refrigeration and radioactivity, patent medicines and space helmets, chocolate chip cookies and atomic parity, cosmetics, diphtheria and rabies vaccinations, bobby pins, non-reflecting glass, leotards, automatic flight control, egg beaters, pulsars, the cotton gin, vacuum canning, maritime signal flares, quinine, X and Y chromosomes, the disposable diaper, and DNA. More often than not, of course, men stole the credit, and mothers of invention spend some time, although not enough, explaining how and why. There are also thumbnail sketches of the inventive mothers and their various difficulties in getting an education and some respect. Dozens of full-length biographies are waiting here to be written of people a lot more interesting than Stevie Nicks and Ozzy Osbourne. It's a book quite radical in its implications, although it presents itself in a fashion altogether too fluffy and forgiving, like a popular magazine article intended to dig us in the ribs instead of kick us in the teeth. Nevertheless, after so much hard work by feminist scholars on neglected women in the arts, literature, education, social work, and politics, it's refreshing and instructive to get this news from the science and technology front. It's also nice to hear again about Isis, the Egyptian goddess who is said to have put the first sail on the first sailboat. But I especially liked the chapter on Hypatia of Alexandria, an actual historical figure, the last scientist of the Golden Age of Pericles. She invented, among other things, the astrolabe that measures the positions of the sun and stars and calculates the ascendant sign of the zodiac, and the hydroscope that determines the specific gravity of any given liquid. Because of her Neoplatonism, and perhaps her sex, zealous Christian monks in A.D. 415 pulled her from her chariot, stripped her naked, raised her skin, rent her flesh with sharp shells, quartered her dead body, and burned those quarters to black ash. Western science wouldn't recover from this martyrdom for another 1,000 years.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Mothers of Invention by Ethelie Ann Vare and Greg Patchick. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, we'll continue our series of interviews with Fresh Air contributors. I'll speak with television critic David Bianculli. For many, watching TV is an idle diversion. For him, it's a full-time obligation. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review a new release of Haydn compositions. Gerard Schwartz conducts the Scottish Chamber Orchestra. And Jan Harald Brundvand will explore the urban legend about the package containing a dead cat, a package that's stolen before it reaches its destination. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.